So, hello, Peter Tatchell.
Good day.
So, Peter is the UK's most indefatigable gay rights campaigner. He's a human rights campaigner more generally. Is there anything else you'd like to say about yourself and by way of introduction?
Well, only that I've been campaigning for human rights now for 54 years. I began at the age of 15 while still at high school in 1967. And I'm currently the director of my own small human rights foundation, the Peter Tatchell Foundation.
Right, great. So I remember like 20 years ago, I saw you every time I switched on the telly, but I don't hear quite so much about you anymore. Have you slowed down at all?
Not at all. The media goes through phases. It's got its favorites, and then you fall out of favor. That's just simply it.
Right. Anyway, so has the battle for gay rights been won in the United Kingdom?
Well, it has very significantly been won. Let's not forget that until 1999, Britain had by volume the largest number of anti-gay laws of any country in the world, some of them dating back centuries. Yet by 2014, every single one of those significant laws had been repealed. That has got to be the biggest, fastest, most successful law reform campaign in British history. I want to take this opportunity to pay tribute to the tens of thousands of LGBT plus people and our straight friends and allies who helped make that happen.
I mean, I can think of somewhere possibly more dramatic. The Republic of Ireland, where I come from, till 1994, all homosexual acts were illegal in the Republic of Ireland. Within 20 years, same-sex marriage was legal, and the only country in the world where that was approved by referendum. So, perhaps more dramatic. So, homosexuality is natural in some people. Is homophobia natural in others?
I think that any form of prejudice is largely rooted on a combination of ignorance, mostly a lack of education about issues of human sexuality, but also in many cases it's driven by political or religious ideologies. So we find that the levels of hostility to LGBT plus people are much greater among people on the far right and among people who hold fairly fundamentalist religious views, whether they be Christian, Muslim, Judaist, or any other form of faith. I think that it's undoubtedly true that there are always going to be some people, albeit a shrinking minority, who have some form of prejudice on whatever issue you talk about, race, gender, sexuality, disability, and so on. But what we do know in Britain is that in the last 30 or so years, the levels of homophobia have dramatically declined. So, in the late 1980s, two-thirds or more than two-thirds of the British public said that they believed homosexuality was mostly or always wrong. Now it is down to 16%, a shadow of its former self, but still more than one in eight of the population. I think that suggests that homophobia and indeed other forms of prejudice are conditional, in part at least, or very significantly, due to social mores, expectations, and values. So I'm very confident that we can move even further towards a post-homophobic society in the long term.
Because reflecting as a schoolboy in the 90s, I really didn't want to be called gay. But I know now from teenagers being called homophobic is a terrible thing to be branded. So how it's shifted. You mentioned the far right. It made me think of Russia, of you're not allowed to promote homosexuality in any sense or any non-traditional relationship to minors. But do you think then Putin is far right by your definition?
Oh, absolutely. Russia is now far, far, far removed from communism. It is a state capitalist oligarchy where billionaires are encouraged and protected by the state, where they fund Putin and his party, and of course, in alliance with the Russian Orthodox Church. look at the way in which Putin has established a police state, heading increasingly towards that of Stalin.
This is not
traditional socialism or communism. It's a perversion which was introduced to some extent by some of the Bolsheviks and then by Stalin, and is now being revisited by Putin. But if you look back in the early ideas of socialist and communist thinkers, they always couched their arguments in favor of democracy, about the extension of democracy to politics, to economics, to social and cultural life. So I would say that Putin is the other side of the far right, which we see in the United States, Europe, and many other countries.
You see, that's the extraordinary thing. If ever there were a country to prove that totalitarianism, left or right, is broadly the same, it's Russia. Because although he appeals to nostalgia for communism, he's in fact promoting really rapacious capitalism, ultra-nationalism, and so on. It's astonishing, the doublethink of some of my Russian pupils who believed in communism but were multimillionaires and would never give a penny to the public purse. Another question. Is Islam inherently anti-gay?
Well, if you read the core text of Islam, Judaism, and Christianity, it is filled with extreme homophobic tracts. But then again, it's all about interpretation. So when it comes to Christianity, many Christians would argue that the homophobia is in the Old Testament and Jesus Christ brought a New Testament. And where in the New Testament there are references or condemnations of homosexuality, it doesn't come from reported words of Jesus, but from his disciple Paul, who did all kinds of other terrible things in the name of Christianity, endorsing slavery, for example, or suggesting that people had a duty to owe allegiance to tyrannical regimes like the Roman occupiers. When it comes to Islam, what's very interesting is that the Quran itself has no explicit condemnations of homosexuality, and certainly it prescribes no punishments. Those things are in the hadiths produced by the Prophet Muhammad. Now, he was a mortal man. But if you are a true Muslim, then your take should be from the Quran alone. Because in the Quran, it states, and this is supposed to be the word of Allah, it states that the Quran is full, complete, requires no interpretation and no addition. So in that case, if you read the Quran and you see that there is no explicit condemnation of homosexuality, then how can you justify, in the name of Islam, homophobia or any similar prejudice? You can't. What happens is that some aspects of the Quran have been interpreted to cover homosexuality. So there's talk about wanton behavior. Well, what is wanton behavior? Who knows what that means? There are many other passages like that. They are vague terms which have been interpreted as covering homosexuality, but in fact do not do so.
Which brings me on to another point. I recently learned you were brought up in a Christian fundamentalist household. Which denomination was that?
Pentecostal.
And you were obviously bombarded with anti-gay propaganda. How did you withstand that?
Well, of course, I imbibed it. As a child, I knew no better. To my parents, homosexuality was a sin on a par with, almost on a par with rape and murder. That was, very, very shocking to me. And, I had a great disdain for homosexuality. But in my teenage years, when I went to work, I met gay people for the first time. And they weren't the monsters that I'd been led to believe. They were, in fact, young people, good-looking, creative, kind, thoughtful young people about my own age. And I thought to myself, well, this is clearly wrong. There's clearly a huge mistake here on the part of Christian churches. They are basing their prejudice, their homophobia, on certain passages in the Old Testament. And as I said earlier, if you're a true Christian, you follow the New Testament. And Jesus brought a New Testament with new ideas about, you know, blessed are the peacemakers, the Good Samaritan, that we are our brothers and sisters keepers, words of kindness and compassion, which are not compatible with any form of discrimination. So very quickly and easily, I concluded that these Christians were wrong, and that since same-sex love between consenting adults did not harm anyone, it could not be morally or ethically wrong.
So you came to the UK, and when was it, 1969?
71.
And although homosexuality had been decriminalised in England and Wales, there was still severe prejudice, and you must have suffered a lot of hatred. What was the most difficult thing you had to cope with then in the 70s?
Well, first of all, let me make it clear that the decriminalisation in England and Wales, and it was only England and Wales in 1967, was very limited and partial. Most aspects of gay male life remained criminal right up until full decriminalisation in 2003. So it was not as if the criminalisation had ended. In fact, police harassment and arrests actually increased fourfold in the years after 1967. There were raids on gay bars and clubs, on private parties, saunas, etc., etc. It was actually quite a repressive era, not necessarily sanctioned by the state, but sanctioned by police chiefs who saw gay and bisexual men as easy targets to boost their arrest and conviction figures, and who, in most cases, never agreed with decriminalisation in the first place. Beyond that, yes, the levels of public homophobia were very, very high. Not 100% by a long shot. There was always a small liberal minority who supported LGBT plus rights. But among the majority, there was very intense both ignorance and prejudice. Back in those days, of course, the medical and psychiatric professions still saw homosexuality as an illness. And at public expense on the NHS, gay and bisexual men and some lesbian and trans people were also subjected to electric shock aversion therapy or drug-induced nausea aversion therapy. This is where the practitioners who are NHS, you know, doctors and psychiatrists were attempting to cure homosexuality, bisexuality, and transgenderism. This practice only really ended in the mid to late 1970s, although I'd say that sort of around 73, 74, it began to fade out of popularity quite quickly. But it still continued probably until the late 1970s. At least one man died under this so-called treatment, and the doctors who killed him have to this day never been reprimanded, and they've never apologised.
But how about you personally? Do you receive hate mail, insulted on the street, or things like that? All that?
Yeah, I mean, being abused in the street, being physically, violently assaulted. I had that, and so did all my friends. It was very, very commonplace. You know, discrimination against LGBT plus people in employment was lawful by default. You know, there was no law against discrimination. There was no protection for LGBT plus employees. Likewise, landlords could refuse to hire or let a premises to a gay person. They could evict an LGBT plus tenant simply because of their sexuality or their gender identity. There was almost no LGBT plus people visible in public life. There were no public figures who were openly gay, no politicians, no pop stars, no entertainers. The closest I think we got was, you know, David Bowie coming out in sort of the early 70s as bisexual. Maybe a couple of other pop stars who sort of alluded to their sexuality, but for the most part, they were all in the closet. And so for young LGBT plus people, there were no positive role models. The only time LGBT plus people ever appeared in the news was when they're exposed as spies, mass murderers, or child sex abusers. That was it.
Mm-hmm. Because you could be sacked, I mean, legally sacked for being gay well into the 80s in all sorts of jobs. So a lot of people in their 20s watching this just won't realise what a different world it was quite recently.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Tony Whitehead, who went on to help found and work with the Terence Higgins Trust, he was sacked by British Home Stores after he came out publicly as gay. That was in 1974. In 1985, Susan Schell, a lesbian social worker in Barking in East London, she was sacked again simply because she was a lesbian. And neither them nor the thousands of others who were similarly sacked had any kind of legal recourse or redress.
Mm-hmm. Okay, in the 60s, did you ever believe the gay movement would succeed to the extent that it has now?
Well, probably the earliest and most significant political event in my life was in 1963, when I was 11 years of age. I heard about the bombing of a black church in Birmingham, Alabama, where four young girls about my own age were murdered by white racists. I can remember thinking to myself at the time, how could anyone kill another human being, let alone four young girls in church on a Sunday morning? And that prompted my interest and support for the Black Civil Rights Movement in the United States. Given my own very fundamentalist Christian upbringing, I identified with Martin Luther King, who was himself a Baptist pastor. I saw him as putting Christianity into action. And so later on, when I took up the cause of LGBT plus rights, this was in 1969, when in my hometown of Melbourne, Australia, there were no LGBT plus organizations, not even any helplines or counseling services. There was absolutely nothing. So I had no template. So I looked to the Black Civil Rights Movement as the model of how to do activism. And I can remember at the age of 17 in 1969 saying to myself, if Black people in America are an oppressed minority and deserve equal rights, which they do, then so do LGBT plus people. And I also calculated, I said to myself, well, looking at the history of the Black civil rights struggle, it's taken a good 50 years for them to win, you know, the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act, and so on in the 1960s. So I remember saying to myself and saying to my friends, that I thought it would probably take 50 years to win LGBT plus legal equality in Western countries like the United States, Australia, and Britain. And so that was a rough sort of guesstimate, but it turned out to be more or less right.
Wow. But did you think it was likely to happen?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, I did. I did believe that we could do it. Yes.
Yes. Because you compare the United Kingdom in the 70s, there were civilizations in the distant past, ancient Greece, where being gay was broadly accepted. So it was something which people could go back to. Interestingly, the British political elite were largely classically educated, and they would have known that homosexuality was broadly accepted in ancient Greece and Rome, but that often didn't make them more broad-minded on this issue. You touched on something else I want to raise
now. Can I just drop that? I mean, you're right, but of course, homosexuality in ancient Greece was very different from same-sex relations today. It largely was not between equals. It mm-hmm. was usually between an older person and a younger person, and it was like a mentoring relationship where an older person would guide a young person in philosophy, mathematics, or whatever, and they would have a sexual relationship as part of that. So that's not what modern homosexuality is all about. So it is different, but you're right in the sense that there was a different perspective on same-sex relations in ancient Greece and indeed in many other civilizations throughout history.
Yeah, notably Enoch Powell, I know largely panned as being a fascist ogre today. He was believed that in gay decriminalisation, which is not what you might have anticipated. But it touches
so did Margaret Thatcher.
Oh, right, OK. Where do you stand on removing the statues of colonisers and generals from the imperial era?
Well, I certainly think that we need to reevaluate the way in which people involved in ghastly crimes are venerated and honoured right across the breadth of this land. You know, I don't think it is right that those who did unspeakable things, whether it be the transatlantic slave trade, the persecution of LGBT plus people, the, you know, burning of women as witches and so on and so on, I don't think they should be memorialized without qualification. Now, whether statues should be removed or whether they should be appended with plaques to explain the context and history, that's a moot point. You know, when the campaign some years ago in Oxford was that Rhodes should fall, the statue of Cecil Rhodes should fall, I said, well, I'm prepared to support the students and the lecturers, what they want. But actually, I thought that probably it would be better to keep the statue, but have a plaque which explained how Cecil Rhodes was responsible for colonization, servitude, and terrible things that happened to African people. But that would be a better way of doing it. So when it comes to the current, you know, debate, I certainly think that it is right and proper that some of the statues of some of the worst people should be removed, or at very least have, you know, plaques added that explain their history. So, you know, Churchill was a great wartime leader, but he was also a racist, a supporter of imperialism and the subjugation of colonial peoples. He opposed Indian independence, for example. I think he is a very mixed figure, and I think, you know, we can't just simply shower him with adulation. We have to put him in his place and context and recognize that he also advocated some very bad things.
Now, as we bring up Rhodes, I recall how you said in the 70s you were a stalwart advocate of the cause of black majority rule in Zimbabwe, of Robert Mugabe, and then you turned out to be Mugabe's fiercest critic. Is it fair to say that Mugabe, he turned out to be everything that his enemies said in the 1970s?
Well, not quite. I think the criticism of him in the 1970s was very ill-placed. You know, I have a copy in my house of ZANU's political program, I think of 1972, which Robert Mugabe co-drafted. And no Democrat or liberal person could disagree. You know, a commitment to a democratic political system based on free and fair elections, a free press, the right to protest, the right to strike, etc. All the basic fundamental human rights principles are enshrined in that document. And I know from people who were in contact with Mugabe and his group that they adhered to that. They did believe all that. But I think over time, Mugabe changed. Power went to his head. He became very insecure, and partly because of various attempts to assassinate him by the white minority regime, but also because of political rivals like Joshua Nkomo. You know, it is fair to say that Joshua Nkomo and Robert Mugabe, albeit primarily Mugabe's forces, were responsible for the liberation of Zimbabwe. But we should not write out of history Joshua Nkomo and his forces as well, because they played a part. And what happened was that after coming to power at the beginning of 1980, Robert Mugabe felt very threatened by the strong support that Joshua Nkomo had in certain parts of the country. And that is why he launched his notorious 5th Brigade to go on a scorched earth policy through the regions of Matabeleland and Midlands, where Joshua Nkomo's support was very strong, to basically try to wipe out or terrorize the opposition. And that is what he did. And from that moment onwards, that's when I turned against him. When he began doing wrong things, I began challenging and protesting against him.
Because that was the thing. Obviously, Zimbabwe had independence, Votes for All, 1980. But it only took about 2 years before he launched that campaign against the Ndebele minority. But the world didn't want to know. It was an atrocity on the scale worse than anything that happened in Ian Smith or even in the 1890s. Not saying that Ian Smith's soldiers didn't kill civilians. They did. But the world didn't want to know. And it seemed to me there was colour prejudice because, you know, Rhodesia, South Africa, they were excoriated internationally, often rightly, mainly because whites were doing it. But if it was black people doing it to black people, well, that was just fine, so long as you called yourself anti-imperialist.
Well, you're absolutely right. There was incredible double standards. When you think about it, the massacres in Matabeleland and Midlands in the 1980s, which are estimated to have killed possibly up to about 20,000 people, mm-hmm. that was the equivalent of a Sharpeville massacre every day for 9 months. Now, when civilians were massacred at Sharpeville in South Africa by the apartheid regime, the whole world was outraged. There were worldwide protests and condemnations. When Mugabe was doing it nonstop for months and months and months, you're right, the world looked the other way. And all these so-called anti-imperialists and anti-colonists, or most of them, just didn't bother. They didn't care. And I just thought that was just so appalling. To me, universal human rights are a fundamental principle. And whether a person is black or white, if they're committing crimes, that has to be called out. You know, we shouldn't base our perspective on who the perpetrator is and who the victim is. Perpetrators of crimes need to be called out. The victims of crimes need to be supported.
So although, you know, white rule in Zimbabwe in the 70s was anti-democratic and racist, isn't it true that its overthrow made things worse for the average Zimbabwean?
Well, I think you've got to put things in perspective. You say things got worse. Well, in fact, actually, things got better for quite a few years. You know, there was an expansion of education. There was big improvement in healthcare to poor people. Lots of things got better. And in particular, black Africans in Zimbabwe had control over their destiny. But it is true that, you know, moving on, particularly in from the late 1980s onwards, things economically began to go not so well because of a policy of Africanization without giving African people the education and tools they needed in order to be professional administrators. Now, of course, there are and were lots of black Africans who had great talent and skills, who had actually been educated under the old Rhodesian system, and they were perfectly capable of running the country. But when Mugabe sought to massively increase Africanization, there often were not the people there with the skills and talents to do those jobs. And plus, there was began to be a lot of corruption, a lot of nepotism, a lot of cronyism. Party faithful and stalwarts got jobs and got land, which they weren't really competent and capable to do. So I think that's the sad aspect of the way Mugabe did things, is that the Africanization process, which was entirely necessary and justified, should have gone hand in hand with much better education and training and support for those Africans who took over positions of responsibility. But at the end of the day, the real flaw, the real problem was not that. It was really the corruption and tyranny of the Mugabe regime, which was so determined to maintain itself in power, whatever the cost. That was the real falling and failing.
What is the main human rights challenge to be overcome worldwide?
Well, there are so many. I mean, if you look at it beyond the narrow definition of human rights, you can say that probably global poverty is the single greatest challenge. And of course, according to United Nations conventions, The right to food, hunger, shelter, home, education, these are also human rights. It's enshrined in the United Nations Convention on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. You look at the situation now where there are well over 600 million people on this planet who are hungry or malnourished. A similar number have no safe, clean drinking water. Well over 1,000 million have no decent homes. They're living in hovels or shanty towns with no clean water, no electricity. The scale of global poverty is phenomenal. Yet the richest 26 people in the world have as much wealth as the poorest 50% of the world's population. That cannot be right. That the massive disjunction between the rich and the poor, a handful of very rich people and a tiny minority, sorry, a handful of very rich people and a huge majority of impoverished people, that cannot be right. That to me is a human rights abuse, because everyone does have the right to safe, clean drinking water, adequate food and nutrition, you know, education, healthcare, and so on. But beyond that, I mean, in more conventional terms, you know, what's been happening in Syria since 2011 is, you know, a monstrous human rights abuse by the Assad regime and by ISIS. Again, what shocks me is so many of my fellow comrades on the left have been silent and failed to protest against the Assad regime. They've given that regime a free pass when it has committed some of the worst crimes for a century. It's probably not in total terms, it's nowhere near the Holocaust or the Second World War, but in terms of, you know, one particular country and the orchestrated systemic mass murder of civilians, the mass torture of innocent people, Syria is very hard to rival. If you look at it, the Syrian regime survives not because the people want it. It survives because of the backing of Russia and Iran and Hezbollah. Now, if this level of state interference was taking place in any other country by the West, there'd be mass protests all around the world, and quite rightly. Just because it's not the West doing it doesn't mean to say that we shouldn't be speaking out against Russian, Iranian, and Hezbollah intervention in the Syria war. I was shocked and stunned. You know, I went on so many protests in solidarity with the civil society democratic movement in Syria, and you'd hardly ever see any Westerners, let alone any left-wing Western people. There were a few, but very, very, very few. And again, it just, to me, indicates double standards. You know, you can't have credibility if you one-sidedly condemn the West for war crimes, and quite rightly, while remaining silent when war crimes are committed by non-Western nations. And what's even shocking is the way which some on the left have turned out to be apologists for the Russian, Syrian, and Iranian regimes. You know, on Twitter and other social media, I'm constantly under attack. I'm accused of being a CIA and MI5 stooge for supporting the peaceful democratic protests of the Syrian people and opposing the Assad dictatorship. This is nonsense. I'm not in any agreement with Western policy on most human rights issues and most international issues when it comes to countries like Syria. But I will take a stand and have taken a stand to support those brave people in countries like Syria and elsewhere who are fighting for their freedoms, for the very freedoms and rights that the left in this country fights for here, but which has failed to fight for there.
The trouble about Syria is there are not many Democrats there. They're very few, very feeble. They're not going to win. It's either going to be ISIS or the Ba'athists. So which would be a better outcome?
Well, I disagree. There are millions of Syrian Democrats. but they've been crushed by Assad. You know, there are protests, there have been protests with tens of thousands of people in cities and towns all over Syria calling for democracy and human rights. You know, the reason why Assad would not allow free and fair elections is because he knew he would lose. And the democratic opposition, the broad-based civil society groups, they would have won. Now, I don't think there would have been any one party that would have won, but there would have been a coalition. One of the inspiring things in Syria, which is almost unreported, are the local coordinating committees. These sprung up all over Syria after the first protests and the repression by the Assad regime. These were civil society groups of people committed to opposing the dictatorship and supporting democracy. They sprang up to replace the Assad stooges in the local communities, to run local services, whether it be education, water, electricity, social services, and so on. And they still exist in those parts of Syria that are not under Assad's control. So I do not accept the choice. It's either Assad or ISIS. I do not accept that at all.
But I would like to see or think you're right, but I just don't think they're going to win, the good guys. Anyway, we could come on to something else. You mentioned poverty and wealth. The staggering thing is how many working class people will vote for their own impoverishment. It makes me think of Donald Trump. What should we learn from the Trump presidency?
Well, of course, it's true that sometimes people do not vote in their own self-interest. They will vote for people who actually, you know, will impoverish them. And we've seen that with Brexit. You know, Brexit is causing a slow, gradual impoverishment of the British people. And, you know, we just look at the way in which Amsterdam has now overtaken London as the top place for financial services. Just look at the way in which 68% of employers and businesses are saying they are suffering as a result of Brexit. That there's huge bottlenecks and delays. And for example, I need some medicine. It comes from Amsterdam. I've been waiting for a month and a half for it because it's been held up because of Brexit. Now, Brexit was supported in part, not entirely, by working class people in the so-called Red Wall seats. They did so, I think, for a number of reasons. In many ways, it was a protest vote, a lashing out at the establishment and the failure of successive governments and parties on all sides, all the major parties anyway, to address their concerns. You know, the left behinds were angry, and I shared their anger and supported their anger. But I think it was misplaced to channel that to Brexit. And Trump has operated in the same sort of way. He's appealed to an often disenfranchised base who feel that successive Republican and Democratic leaderships have failed them. And indeed they have. You know, that's why I was a great supporter of Bernie Sanders, because whatever you think about the man, he was trying to change things. And what the irony is that in 2016, when he was competing against Hillary Clinton for the Democratic nomination, polls suggested that he stood a better chance of defeating Donald Trump than Hillary Clinton. And that's because he was reaching out, kicking the establishment, and standing up for the little guy, the little woman. And I think that we need to rethink our politics. You know, this, you know, the combination of Brexit and COVID is an occasion for us to not return to business as usual, but to build back better. And we have to do that if we are to overcome the sense of disillusionment and disenchantment that so many people feel about the political process and about the main parties. And that is why, of course, reforming the electoral system is so crucial to that. You know, it is monstrous to think that no British governing party has won a majority of the public vote since 1931. Every single party since has won power based on a minority of votes. So even Thatcher's great landslide in 1983 was based on, I think, 43% of the vote. The same with Tony Blair's landslide in 1997. It was based on the same figure, roughly 43% of the vote. That is not a majority. And now, our present government of Boris Johnson in 2019, he won less than 43% of the vote, but bagged 55% of the seats and 100% of the power. That is not democratic. It is not what the Chartists and suffragettes fought for. And it's not what most British people think is fair, because the opinion polls show, and have consistently shown for some time now, that most people want a reform of the voting system to make sure that the proportion of seats won by a party closely match the proportion of votes won by that party. And that's why, to renew our democratic system and to revive public trust and confidence in politics, we have to have electoral reform. We've got a form of proportional representation already in Wales, in Scotland, in Northern Ireland, and the London Assembly. These systems maintain both the constituency link and the add-on representation as well. It works in all these parliaments and assemblies. Why can't it work for Westminster as well?
Now, you may remember 10 years ago, there was a referendum on the alternative vote, which obviously was defeated, but we could pass it anyway. Now, curiously, the only time a government has commanded majority support...
Could I just interrupt you there?
Go ahead.
Alternative vote is not proportional representation. Sure. It would have produced the same distorted result, roughly the same or slightly different distorted results as first past the post. So the reason why lots of people were not engaged with the alternative vote is because it was no significant change.
Okay, sorry. And I was going to say 2010, that Conservative Liberal Democrat coalition, if you put the percentage of the Conservatives and the Lib Dems together, that would have been something like almost 60% of the vote, oddly. But anyway, that's not what people voted for.
Yeah, but that's not right. It's not what people voted for, and none of the governing parties had in their own right majority support.
You're correct. I mean, people didn't vote Liberal Democrat because they wanted a mainly Tory administration and vice versa. Yeah. Let's see. Are you still in the Green Party?
I am indeed.
I mean, what are we going to do about climate change? Being realistic about politics and economics, what are we going to do?
Well, the proposed Green New Deal, which is supported and has been researched and endorsed by so many leading ecologists and economists and people from all different political parties, that really is the way forward. It does chart a map that can not only help reduce climate change and put it into reverse, but can also actually boost the economy. So it's estimated that some of the core elements of a Green New Deal are things like a comprehensive program of energy conservation, energy insulation, and renewable energy sources. These proposals can, between them, create hundreds of thousands of new jobs, new skilled and semi-skilled jobs, some low-skilled jobs. It's exactly what we need to reboot the economy. So, for example, when it comes to energy use, roughly about 30% of all the energy we create is wasted. It's either lost in transmission or wasted because of poor insulation or inefficient systems. So energy conservation going hand in hand with energy optimization, for example, so you have fuel efficient vehicles, airplanes, factories, offices, and so on. That can not only dramatically reduce carbon emissions, but to install that, create hundreds of thousands of new jobs. Renewable energy, recently wind has overtaken coal and gas as the main source of Britain's energy supply. Mm-hmm. There's still much more to do to ensure that we have even greater wind power. But again, there are other options as well. solar panels, the new latest generation solar panels are much more efficient, about 20 or 30% more efficient than the old ones. There is no reason why there shouldn't be a mandatory requirement for all new buildings to be fitted with these high efficiency solar panels, and for old ones to be retrofitted. That kind of proposal, which is being done in some other countries like Germany, for example. I mean, Germany, I think, gets 20% or more of its power from solar already. Homeowners can sell their surplus solar power back to the grid and get paid for it. So this is the way to go. And of course, a lot of people think, well, you need sun for solar power. You don't. You need light. So even on a sunless day, but a reasonably bright day, you will get solar power. And we need to invest in, new ways of ensuring that solar power can be more efficiently and effectively stored, so that it can be stored during the day and then used at night and so on. One of the things that is extraordinary to me is that we're not really exploiting wave and tidal power. Back in the 1970s, Britain was one of the pioneers of wave and tidal power. Yet the Thatcher government cut the funding and then the programs fell to pieces. We could develop that and become a world leader and actually export the technology for wave and tidal power. So as well as providing our own energy needs through wave and tidal power, we could actually create jobs and get boost to the exchequer through exporting that technology overseas and around the world.
Coming back to Brexit, which you opposed, how realistic is it for the United Kingdom to rejoin the European Union in the next few years?
I don't think rejoining the EU is on the cards for the next few years. I think, the decision has been taken. We'll have to see how it pans out. Things might come good in the end. It's hard to see how, but they could. And I'd be willing to give it a go. We are out, so there's no point saying that we can do things any different right now. We have to make the best of it right now. Mm-hmm. But I think, further down the line, in perhaps 10 or 20 years' time, it may be appropriate to reconsider whether that was a good decision or not, and whether we should remain outside the European Union or rejoin. But that has got to be we need some time to let things settle, and there needs to be a public conversation and consultation about that.
One thing that surprised me about the old days is you believe that Northern Ireland should be expelled from the UK, fused with the Republic of Ireland during the Troubles, despite Northern Ireland, from at least 1981, at least allowing homosexuality, when the Republic of Ireland did not, was more of a theocracy at that time. Why did you take that view?
Well, of course, I've never judged my politics or based my politics on LGBT plus issues alone. They are a consideration, but they're not necessarily the overriding consideration. Mm-hmm. I think the decision by the British colonial state to divide Ireland was very, very wrong. There was a referendum and the majority of Irish people voted to be independent, but Britain intervened to artificially stop that happening and to retain the northern counties as part of the United Kingdom. That was an incredibly wrong thing to do. And we've been living with the consequences, the terrible consequences of that ever since. So yes, I've always supported, long before Tony Blair, the idea of a negotiated political settlement to withdraw British troops and to reunify Ireland with proper protections and safeguards for the minority Protestant and loyalist community in the north. I don't see how that's wrong or why that should not happen. Indeed, Brexit has made it more and more likely, I think. I mean, it's interesting that there are some polls that seem to suggest that public opinion in the north is moving towards supporting a united Ireland, because people just, they do have a loyalty or a love of Britain and so on, but for practical and economic purposes, they're seeing all the problems, and maybe some of them are starting to think, well, perhaps I'm going to be better off if we're all together in one united Ireland as we once were and as we once perhaps should have been.
So, yeah, I mean, obviously, we did have a united Ireland. I mean, until the IRA came along, we were united, part of the United Kingdom. Well, the other thing is, partition of Ireland was agreed to by the Sinn Féin delegation in 1921. And there was an election in the south of Ireland where the pro-treaty side won 75% of the vote. So I just think, you know, Republic of Ireland, we've agreed to that again and again. Or about the Anglo-Irish Agreement or the Good Friday Agreement. The whole of Ireland voted on the same day. 85% of people voted for the Good Friday Agreement, which said that Northern Ireland is part of the United Kingdom and shall always remain so unless most people in Northern Ireland choose to leave the UK and join the Republic. But do you still think Northern Ireland should be forced out or what?
No, I've never been in favour of Northern Ireland being forced out. But I think that vote for the Good Friday Agreement was basically a vote for an end to the war, for peace, for reconciliation. And, you know, I wholeheartedly support that. The question is, how do we go forward? What happens now? And as I said, there seems to be a slow but steady movement towards people in the north increasingly reconsidering whether they want to remain part of the United Kingdom or become part of a united Ireland. I would never want to see that happen by force. I would want it to be agreed by the people.
Now, another issue, you know, you see Labour and the Tories in the opinion polls, they're at neck and neck with the economy and coronavirus and so on. Labour should be far ahead. Why do you think Labour's doing so poorly?
Well, you're right. I mean, it is quite shocking that Labour is so far behind, given the calamities of the current Conservative government, not just on Brexit and COVID, but on a whole range of issues. I think that what has been very lacking from Keir Starmer's leadership is a clear vision of what Labour stands for. You know, he's been like, you know, it's been tit for tat over issue after issue, but no clear vision, no grand idea of what Labour would do and how Labour would take the country forward. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what he needs now. He needs a vision.
Right. Well, Mr. Tashel, it's been a very intriguing hour. I think there's a great biography in you, autobiography. Have you written one?
I haven't. I'm too busy.
Okay.
I know I should, but I'm just too busy. Well,
It's been highly delightful to become reacquainted with you. Hope to meet you sometime when lockdown is over. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
I'd just like to say, give my greetings and best wishes to all your listeners and viewers. Mm-hmm. And say, if anybody's interested, please go to my foundation's website, which is petertatchellfoundation.org. There you'll see resume of all the different campaigns we're working on. And in the top right-hand corner, there's a button called Join Us. If you go there, give us your email address, we will send you a weekly email bulletin on human rights and LGBT plus issues, often many things and many causes that are not well known, some of them very funny and frivolous, some of them very serious. It's quite entertaining. It's entirely free, but do feel free to sign up and subscribe, and we'd be happy to send you our bulletins each week. And the second thing is that my foundation does not have any form of funding other than we get what we get from well wishers. So if you support the work I do, then feel free to click on the donate button in the top right hand corner and send us a small donation or a large donation as you can. That will help keep us going. But thank you all very, very much. It's been great to be part of this podcast. And thank you, George.
You're very welcome. Thank you for your time. Goodbye.
Goodbye.